Welcome to the fourth episode of Ask the Expert. I am Christoph Schulze, Project Manager at The Autonomous. For those who are not familiar with The Autonomous, we are a platform for bringing together global players in autonomous driving to collaboratively work on the biggest challenges in our domain. If you have been listening to our early episodes of Ask the Expert and you are wondering, where's Julia? Well, Julia and I will share the moderator role for the upcoming episodes of this format, and my role will be to focus on technical questions during the course of the interviews. Speaking of technical experts, I would like to introduce you to our guest today, Erik Schmidt from TT Tech Auto AG in Vienna. As you might know, TT Tech Auto is a global player in autonomous driving, focusing on safe software and hardware solutions. TT Tech Auto is also the initiating company of The Autonomous. Erik has been with TT Tech for more than 18 years and is Director of Lead Engineering and Safety. He also holds regular lectures at the University of Applied Sciences here in Vienna. When I joined TT Tech back in 2018, my first training in my first week was a safety awareness training held by Erik, and I was entertained by his very creative way of presenting and impressed by his vast safety expertise. Erik, great to talk to you again.
Yeah, thanks for having me here, and also thank you for this kind introduction. I'm happy to be here and to contribute to the entertainment aspect, which I think is an interesting keyword that you used. Very often, I think the safety topics do have an entertainment aspect, but it is not entertainment in the sense of relaxation, but it is a kind of education aspect that I want to be aware of things. And I think that's exactly what you felt when you were participating in the onboarding training on functional safety basics and the safety awareness training. That's where you notice that there are things that you kind of knew them, but you haven't seen them in this context. And that's where you get an additional insight. And that's, I would say, how we should treat safety. It's an important topic and it's an interesting topic.
Indeed, Erik. But before we talk about safety in autonomous vehicles, there is one question that I actually never ask you, and I would like to use this public opportunity to do so. The question is, did you ever get mistaken for the former CEO of Google?
Well, actually, it only happened, I would say, after I mentioned it, that there is a very important or very well-known person out there. But I was never kind of called or emailed in the sense of this mix-up. No, I think my name, Erik Schmidt, is probably much more widely spread on this planet than we think, because my first name and my last name are, let's say, ordinary names, and that's why this combination exists quite often on the planet. But I have never met the very famous Erik Schmidt from Google, but we share the same name.
Okay, interesting. Erik, let's come to the technical part of today. As you might know, the overall goal of The Autonomous is to bring companies together to work on increasing the safety of autonomous vehicles, especially on SAE level 4. Why is safety so important in the context of autonomous driving?
Well, to start with, I would say safety is really important when we generally talk about driving. So moving 1 ton of steel through the environment with other participants taking part in the traffic situation on public roads is obviously related to safety. It could always become a life-threatening event if an accident happens. So I think that's the obvious part. But when we move into the direction of autonomous driving, or I would like to more call it highly automated driving, when we move in that direction, we feel that there's a big change coming, that we are moving the responsibility from the human being, which might not be perfect, but is the actor that we trust in public roads. When someone is driving a car and has a driver's license, we in principle trust this person. But if we move to an electronic system, of obviously the responsibility for this electronic system is very high. And I think that's exactly why the safety topics are so dominant when we are moving forward in this automation level for automated driving.
We know that there are companies out there claiming to have level 4 features close to serious deployment. Do you consider the currently available technology to be safe enough to let drivers activate those features?
I would say what we have demonstrable today is, I would call it the basic functionality, or sometimes I could even call it nice weather software. So we have the functionality available for certain conditions. So under these conditions, it works. The conditions might be related to the sensors and their capability to correctly sense the environment, but the conditions might also be related to keeping the driving situation in a simple context, in a not so complicated wild driving scenario that we could imagine in a heavy traffic in an inner city driving situation. That's so complex that I think we have to restrict to certain areas where we say this is the kind of driving situation that we can handle with the system. The system is designed for this, it can do it, it's well tested, and then I think we can release the responsibility from the human driver and can put it onto the electronic system. But in the general sense of, I would say, allowing this vehicle to drive in every driving condition, every public road situation, here I think we will have to stay with some restrictions for a while, because the human person is still the superior decision maker when it comes to driving situations under, let's say, special conditions, like how do I behave if I notice that things are not as I normally expect them, but there's something different today, like lots of dust flying through the air, disturbing the visibility. That obviously is a special situation and needs special care. And every human driver is aware of this specialty when it happens. And I think that's the reason why we trust the human being very well, even though the human being, of course, is also not perfect, and also a technical system will not be perfect, but we should try to use it in the environment where it can operate safely and well. And we have to keep it restricted not to operate under conditions where it's not really designed for.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
I would say that this could lead to the first deployments on, let's say, very special restricted areas, like a specific part of an autobahn which has some special conditions met, is well documented on a map and things like that. That might be helpful to restrict the operational design domain where it's used to simple scenarios first. And then with confidence that the system has more and more capabilities, then to extend this to more and more complex scenarios. But I still think the general level that we need for unrestricted usage is not achieved on the electronic level yet.
So I understand your statement, Eric, that you see maybe the highway, the autobahn, as maybe the first ODD where we will see level 4.
Yes, that I would say that makes sense when we're talking about public roads. When we are talking about special areas, I could imagine many more situations where people movers might be using some special areas on an airport or things like that. These could be additional autonomous driving situations where the electronic system has the necessary capabilities already and can be deployed there.
Eric, in your long career, you have seen and talked to many companies around this planet. How important is it to have a good safety culture within a company? Would you include a feedback culture as part of such a safety culture?
Absolutely. I think in the end, all this engineering discipline we are doing has to be well balanced with the safety culture, well balanced with the feedback culture, information culture. And to be honest, I'm not quite sure when I have met a certain company for a business interaction, how deep the safety culture is actually visible in such an interaction. You do not always get insight into the internal communication channels, but you can get small hints. And I think especially when it comes to safety, the very nature of safety is that it's only safe if you have not overlooked something. So missing out a certain piece is actually the killer of your safety. And when it comes to safety culture, you have to be aware of this topic, that if you build a system to make it safe and you have covered 99% of the cases, but this 1% was outside of your visibility, then you actually have built an unsafe system in the end. And to avoid that, you have to have a mechanism to become aware of this missing part. And that means you will have to have a very well established communication culture, also to talk about problem areas which are not so well known. So I think the commonality across all safety people, let's call it safety experts in companies working with safety, is they want to have a wide view on the entire topic. They don't want to know just a small part of it. They want to know the whole story, so nothing is overlooked. And in principle, I would say that can only work if you have a good communication culture in place. And this communication culture also includes that if a certain defect is detected or an additional limitation or risk is identified, that you have to have a method to make it communicated into the right channels with nobody feeling embarrassed or feeling insulted because this and this information is now available. So yes, I think safety culture is very different in very many companies, but the good safety companies absolutely have to have a good safety culture, because you cannot handle it on the, let's call it, technical expertise level alone. It has to be a group activity by the human beings, and that means you have to have communication and trust and interaction well established.
Thanks, Eric. I would like to, with the next question, to go a little bit more into the technical details, because my opinion is that the requirement of safety is not limited to a specific hardware or software, because it affects more or less the whole system. Can you tell us a little bit more about the puzzle pieces needed to make autonomous vehicles safe?
Well, I would say the first problem with safety is it's not that simple that you just write a list of the puzzle pieces you need and put them together and you're finished. I give you an extreme example. If your task is you want to build a table, then all you need are the parts, the legs and the plate and the screws. And when you put them all together, all these puzzle pieces are put together, the table is finished and it works. When you talk about safety, it's not so easy to identify what are the puzzle pieces you need to put together. But you must be aware that if you build a technical system and you have a certain area where a certain hazard could happen, a certain fault that could trigger an accident, then that is an area that you have to have a countermeasure for. And the puzzle piece of safety would be the puzzle piece you put onto this risk to make it controllable. So when are you finished with your safety? Well, you're finished when you covered all the relevant faults, and that means it's much harder to say that the safety is finished than to say I am finished in building a table, right? So I would say these key puzzle pieces on a very high level have to cover the security topics, where you have to be aware there could be an intelligent attacker that tries to create, for instance, an accident, or maybe he doesn't even want to create an accident, he just wants to demonstrate that he can control the vehicle and was not aware of the consequences that might happen. You could have a defect in the hardware or in the software that leads to a certain misbehavior. That is the puzzle piece that we focus on a lot as a company, as TTTech, by providing a safe execution platform. But you also have to be aware of much more complex safety problems, like your sensors could be insufficient to detect the environment of the automated driving vehicle correctly. So that is another possibility that might lead to a hazard that also needs to be tackled, and where puzzle pieces of safety need to be put to cover them. And in fact, there's another one that's actually the human interaction. All the human interaction could be potentially the trigger for a hazard as well. You could imagine a person that is using the automated driving vehicle and thinks it's now automatedly driving, but in reality it has moved to manual mode and the driver has to control the driving task himself, but he didn't know that it is his turn to drive. So these are all puzzle pieces that you need to cover, and in each one of them there are of course even more things to consider. Because as I said before, it's not enough just to demonstrate the functionality under standard nice weather conditions. You have to make sure the system is capable to perform this function under all conditions, and that includes faulty conditions like I have a broken sensor.
Eric, you were mentioning the safe execution platform provided by TTTech Auto. So my next question is going towards the direction of how does TTTech Auto actually contribute to what we call the Safety Grand Challenge. Can you tell us a little bit more about what you are working on?
Well, I would say we are trying to set up the fundamental operating system, the fundamental system, how to set up a complex electronics architecture that is capable to perform the highly automated driving task. Now, that might sound like a simple task because it's not the real driving task, the real interpretation of sensor information, but it is like just the supporting activity to provide a safe execution platform for all this complex software to correctly be executed and to exchange data between different units and so on. So this, I think the key term I like to use to describe our product, and by the way, we call it MotionWise, is to have a safe execution platform in place that is capable to support the customers that develop automated driving functions in such a way that they have a safe and robust, reliable execution platform they can host their software on. So it's not really the driving function itself we are working on, but we are providing the right kind of surrounding to make it reliable and deterministic in its behavior to get the complexity under control. Because actually, the complexity of the automated driving function is so high and the software that needs to be implemented is so complex, you have to have a well-organized way how to host it, how to execute it, how to exchange data between different units. And only if this is well-organized and safe, then you can build a safety-related automated driving function on top of that. So I would like to say we're kind of responsible to make sure we have the basic setup well organized and running. And we also help to get the complexity of the overall driving task under control. And yes, it makes a lot of sense to put some restrictions on the development of the software of the driving task, like, for instance, to make sure that all software components that are involved stay within their time boundaries and are well organized in a pre-planned manner as far as possible, and leave a little bit of wiggle room for the software then, of course, to adapt to the current driving situation.
There are a couple of widely known standards out there that are addressing safety-related topics. We all know ISO 26262 focusing on functional safety, and ISO/PAS 21448 focusing on SOTIF, safety of the intended functionality. Do you think that those standards address the challenges needed to bring autonomous vehicles on the road? Where do you see gaps that would need to be filled?
So I have to confess, the first time I read the ISO 26262, I was actually disappointed. But to be honest, if you look across all the available standards that are out there, and there are many more than the two that you mentioned, they are not designed in the way that they provide technical advice in the sense this is how you implement it and this is how you get autonomous driving or highly automated driving safe. They actually only talk about the process, how to do it. They do not give good guidance on the technical, let's call it, challenges and how to overcome them. But obviously, if we do not exactly know how to implement something, but we have certain rules on the processes around it, then at least describing these processes is the best we can do, and that's how we can make use of these standards. So in that sense, the standards are helpful to give guidance on what are the necessary development steps that I have to do, but they are not the let's call it the easy cookbook how to program a highly automated driving function, right? So they do not provide the creative parts of the development. They only provide, let's call it, the guardrails in which boundaries this development has to happen. And to fill these gaps is exactly the engineering challenge which is ahead of us. It takes creativity, it takes knowledge, it takes good sensors, it takes a good combination of multiple different disciplines, and that's perfectly fine. But the standards in that sense are more like guardrails in this arena, and are not direct cookbooks for how to really implement it.
Interesting, yeah. As you might know, Eric, in our first T autonomous working group called Safety and Architecture, we are working on the definition of a reference solution for a fault-tolerant architecture for an L4AD feature. Do you think that the collaborative formulation of such reference solution helps us towards the goal of safe autonomous driving? If yes, how can other companies profit from such a reference solution?
Well, I think it does have a benefit in the sense that it supports the general idea, let's put our heads together and work together on the safety topics when we are exploring new grounds. But then we separate again and we compete when we're talking about implementing certain functionality and demonstrating that the product we have developed is superior to what is provided by my competitor. So there's competition on the function level, but there should be cooperation on the safety level. And this perfectly makes sense. And that's actually how the automotive industry has worked together very well in the past. There were only very few occasions where safety was used for a competitive advantage. And I would say today it's absolutely to the benefit of the consumers that the collaboration on the safety topics has such a long tradition in automotive. That's why all cars have seat belts, all cars have a standardized way of lighting, and the lighting is very helpful for moving in public roads when it's dark, so that works very nicely. And still, there's some competition there in, let's call it, the style and the design of the lights. But in general, the lighting is very well regulated because it's very important for safety and it has some redundancy in it and it has colors in it and it has dimensions and things well specified for the sake of safety. So in that sense, I think safety is the right topic for collaboration. And when we're talking about something new, like moving forward in highly automated driving to a higher level of automation, this safety topic needs collaboration and better understanding, not just to protect a single individual from an accident, but also to make sure that society as a whole can judge and accept the new technology because it is well-crafted in its safety aspects and understood and known. And the on that level, I think collaboration is absolutely essential. And the aspect of then splitting up into different functionalities, showing competition, which capabilities my vehicle has compared to that of a competitor, that is exactly going to continue then on that level, but it should not be happening directly on the safety side.
Very interesting, Eric. Let me formulate this question maybe a little bit more specifically, because you were mentioning that the standards are more focusing on the process side and how to do things. In this working group, we're working on reference solutions. So actually an architecture, a reference architecture that can build the basis for individual implementations. Do you think that this, let's say, shared or collaborative approach for defining reference solution might be a good prototype to bring autonomous vehicles to the road?
Well, absolutely. I would say, let's assume there is no such collaboration and one company has decided to go for a completely different architecture and thinks it's going down the right track. And after a very long development cycle finds out, no, it's an unsafe solution. It has significant weaknesses for a certain kind of fault or something. Then all this money was lost and needs to be kind of redeveloped to follow a different architecture. And this reminds me a little bit of the competition that took place long time ago when the discussion was, we're going to introduce something new and it's called electricity and we're going to do it with direct current or are we going to do it with alternating current? And in principle, both of them are, of course, have their dangers to the human life. But after deciding to go either this way or that way, then the surrounding conditions were well designed and crafted to make it safe for the humans to use it, to get it widely spread and so on. In fact, it did not really matter if it would be this one or that one. But with the decision to go for a certain solution jointly together, the benefit for the consumers is that they get a more mature system out there, even though there might be multiple vendors providing this service. So I think when we are at the beginning of a new technology, to put the experts together and to decide to go for a certain solution has a strong benefit for humanity, because it has the maximum knowledge of this uncertain topic in there. And with this direction, I would say a general movement in the right direction can get started. And then still on the detailed level, there will be individual differences, implementations of different functionality content, of different operational designs, but the general concept should be aligned and should be followed together, and that has a strong benefit for all consumers in the end, that they get a safe and mature product in the end.
That was a very nice analogy, Eric. Yeah. thanks for that. I guess we may have many young listeners on this podcast. Yeah. So I would like to ask you, if you were at the beginning of your career today, what would you choose to study and specialize in? What is the most important skill needed in the upcoming years?
Well, obviously, the time where I studied is a long time ago, and I'm still very pleased with the design, with the decisions I took that time. And I would say, going for an engineering discipline, like in my case, I chose applied physics, is a good way to go. It should be something that is in your key area of interest. It should be something that is a bit more than just doing what others are doing. It should be something that sparks you. And to be honest, I would like to say the key skill that you should train doing your education is problem solving. I know there is no study that claims this is the study of problem solving, right? We call them differently. There might be software engineering. There might be hardware engineering, chip development. There might be material science. I don't know. Sensor development. All kinds of engineering disciplines have their own community for advancing their field and for advancing science and providing education to the students. But in the end, what really counts is the capability of problem solving, and the complexity of tasks we have ahead of us is enormous. So whoever says, oh, you don't have to do software development anymore, that's all going to be done by some artificial intelligence, AI supercomputer, I think that problem has not understood that we are moving into so complex problem areas that the problem-solving capability is the only way to tackle these complex development tasks and to make progress at this mature level of engineering that we have already reached. So I would think these kind of engineering disciplines that train your problem-solving capability and that are in line with your personal interest, that's the right thing to do. And you might also have to keep an eye on the important side aspect that you have to have a good overview of the technical elements that are around us. It's not enough to specialize on one very special focus topic. Maybe your career will bring you into such a very specific area on the way, that's fine. But in your education, I think you should have a broad understanding of multiple different disciplines, and that includes hardware and software and electronics and things like that that need to be combined to build a new innovative product.
Interesting. So we talked about our young listeners. Since we might also have some managers in our audience, what would you recommend those managers? What are the priorities they need to have the companies focus on, besides, of course, hiring the before mentioned young listeners?
Well, I think all managers that are involved in technical engineering development topics also have to have a basic understanding of the technology that they are using. And they have to be very good communication experts. Why? Well, because when an engineer is requested by a manager to implement something and the manager asks him, can you do it? The engineer will probably answer, yes, I can. I'm working on it right now and maybe at date X, I'll have it. But that's exactly the point where the manager then has to dig deeper with this, these questions and has to ask, if you say you can do it until that date, what are the side conditions? What are the restrictions? What are the risks? What are the additional conditions you need to mention to make me aware of the entire scope of this development? Because the normal, let's call it, reaction of an engineer is always to overestimate his own development capability. And that's where the managers then get the impression that everything is available, everything is finished, and it's all completely solved and easily available. And that's not correct. So when the manager receives the answer from the engineer, yes, I can do it, the manager has to be aware that in a complex development task, there are always additional conditions and side informations that need to be exchanged as well. So the answer actually will be, yes, I can do it, but I can only do it under the following conditions. And these conditions need to be found out. And the manager has to be aware that this is a task that will be essential for the success of a product or a project, to have not only a certain amount of development work done, but also to have all necessary conditions and all necessary restrictions well known. And of course, they need to be somehow shared in the right context to make sure that the expectations toward the product are realistic and correct.
Eric, our podcast episode is coming to an end. Thank you very much for taking your time and giving us some insights today. I think the audience could feel your passion for safety and autonomous driving. Thank you also to all of you who listened today. I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Eric. If you have any suggestions for our new Ask the Expert format or questions for our next episodes, please reach out to us via our contact form on the website or directly via email through contact@theautonomous.com. See you next time.